presumably there was regular tours around the...
Oh, yes. We did things like...
Pickets and things like that.
Oh, yes. Pickets. Mass pickets every day. Yeah. I remember that we organised this march through Liverpool where we hired a brass band. We had a bit of, how to put it, panache and flair.
A bit of flair, yeah.
And we marched from the pierhead to the Bootle, down to Gladstone Dock. And we took our collecting tins, and we went in every pub and cafe on the way, collecting for the strike. I went into this cafe, and I said, excuse me, I'm collecting for the Blue Union dispute. And this, it wasn't it, it's a chip shop. This bloke said, I'm not giving any money to any fatted striking dockers. And this woman picks the chips and fish up and shoved them straight in his face and said, well, my fatting husband's a striking docker, you can fuck off. And I remember one of the very good responses we got at the Gladstone Dock. There used to be this boozer, was it? The Caradoc.
The Carry, bloody hell.
And they used to have music and entertainment. And these ladies who were, some people work in factories, other people work other ways. And they were the most generous towards the strike. Every sort of local hooker rolled up in a quid, 2 quid in the strike kitty. And the American seaman. So we had regular mass meetings, mass votes on continuation of the strike, and all the things that I think are essential, i.e. the democratic participation of the strikers. They were not decisions that were taken. Bert Aylward came to the meeting with the full-time officials and said, right, you're all on strike, none of you get paid. The men are out, you're out. And he said to me, I was treasurer, he said, right, they all get paid what they get on Social Security. So one of the sort of strike leaders, full-time officials, who shall remain nameless, said, but we can't claim Social Security, which they couldn't. He said, that's not a problem. He said, Bob will work out what you would get, and then he'll deduct the rest from your wages as a donation to the strike fund. He said, and if you don't like it, he said, I don't mind. He said, you don't have to do it. He said, but tomorrow morning at the mass meeting, I'll get up and read your names out.
That was it. Yeah.
So he said, no, so we have a vote. Yeah. He said, they were all on fucking, they all had to pay their... Right.
So, but the, obviously in Liverpool, all the men didn't come out.
No.
So, what docks actually worked? What sections of docks, should we say?
A bit everywhere.
Yeah.
It isn't possible to single out any dock that was 100% out. Nor is it possible to single out any dock that was 100% in.
No, I was thinking, because the Gladstone Dock was known, as the CP stronghold. Or
no, not the Gladstone, no. Gladstone was not the CP stronghold.
The Kremlin.
Kremlin was number three.
Number three control. Yeah. I thought it was Gladstone, wasn't it?
No, that was number three. That was called the Kremlin.
Yeah.
Gladstone Dock was number one.
I thought Gladstone was number one.
And Gladstone Dock was led by Crosby.
Yeah.
Who being one of the seven dockers in 51.
Who also broke the strike in 55. He actually crossed the picket lines.
Did he?
Yeah. There was a report in the newspaper that Crosby went in. I thought he only did for a couple of hours as a token, but he actually stood up and said, I think this strike's wrong, and walked in. Because all the press were there to report it, so it must have been staged.
By then, he was a bit of an inconsequential figure.
Yeah.
But there was the bloke who was the brand secretary, there was a guy called George Green.
Oh yes, George Green, yeah.
You met him?
No, he's on the Port Works Committee.
So
he went to the Blue, didn't he?
Yes, was a Blue brand secretary.
He was in the same branch as Jim Bember. Because they've got these branch records with George
That's
Green.
Right.
And
he
Jim
would
Bember.
Be, yes, he would.
Well, no, what I was thinking was that whereas in London you had the CP, definitely didn't come out and opposed the strike and worked against the strike.
Yes.
In Liverpool, the CP came out.
That's right, they did.
Because I talked with Frankie Deegan, and he said that what they did was they felt they had no choice. And this is what Frank said, they took a decision. I mean, they must have all got together.
It came out and agitated outside.
Came outside and gave leaflets saying that they thought the strike was wrong, but they were out. And the way one of them put it was that they were the rump of the Port Workers Committee.
Yeah, I mean, could say, this was a sort of principal position. So
yeah.
You don't support the strike, you come out and argue against it. It was determined by the relationship of forces.
Mm.
Because the CP rested on the most left, you know, in general on the left.
Mm.
And the left was overwhelmingly with the Blue Union.
Mm.
In parts, what had been the base of the CP shifted. Now, when I say the base, like, let's put it in a more schematic way. There's the Communist Party members, 15 of them or so. Then underneath, he's got his closest fellow travellers, another 30 of them. And then there's 500 or 600 people throughout the Port of Liverpool who relate to Jackie Lydon, Deegan and people like that, who were never in the CP and never would join it. But now that wing, a lot of that had gone over to the Blue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah.
And therefore, to keep any contact with that, it had to fucking be outside the gate.
Yeah.
So it wasn't due to some principal position, it was due to an adaptation to where its wider base had gone.
But then again, people like Frankie Deegan, for instance, struck me as someone who was, you know, like we were talking about people who were dockers first and involved in politics second.
Yeah.
Frankie Deegan was a CP member who was a docker first. And
I'm not criticising Deegan individually.
No, I think...
What I'm saying is...
I think he himself really realised that, actually.
That's what determined what the CP did in Liverpool. Because in London they could scale quite manually.
Yeah. Well, they did, didn't they?
Yes, of course they did, because of the different relationship of forces. Yeah.
They only reckoned, well, the maximum was 10,000 men. 7,000 of them must have been blue men.
Yes,
easily. So it couldn't have been more than 2,000 or 3,000 TNG men.
No.
That means that the whole docks must have been in Tilbury and all those other places, especially. Yeah. The Blue, the Royal Docks probably was the strongest, I would imagine. Royal and Sunny, but the Blue had a fair amount of influence. But I mean, it's interesting, this fact that there you are, you've got a strike, well organised, you know, you've got your regular meetings and that, but even within the CPL, and yet you still didn't get the whole of the docks out. Some men were still persisting to go in.
Mm.
Was that because of pressure from the TNG officials? Or pressure from the employers? Or what?
Well, I think, and I'd like to finish tonight on this, if you don't mind.
No.
I think it was something that there a lot of the rank and file... Look, workers don't give up losing money easily.
Yeah.
And the docks always had a long line of solidarity, much more than any other industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we went through this before about the community and so on. But if you not join the Blue, you're hoping they'll fucking win.
Mm.
And you say, well, I might come out. And then you see, within a matter of hours of the strike stuff, that the Blue Union leadership was scabbing on its own membership.
Mm.
Don't you think that's a fucking good reason for staying in that game?
Possibly, yeah.
I think that was an enormous fact. Enormous fact.
So it really had a big effect on
it. Oh, tremendous. It's affected some of the Blue.
Yeah.
But how would you feel if your unions call you out on strike and then suddenly all its leadership turn around and say, fuck it, go back?
Mm.
That would piss you off as a member of that union. Now, you and I are getting a different, you've been in an organised revolutionary group, you roll our sleeves and say, fucking no.
Yeah.
But the rest of the workers look to leaders.
Yeah.
But imagine you're not in that. And you've been asked to come out and strike for its recognition with the leadership telling its membership, go back.
Yeah. And yet for all that, the strike lasted 6 weeks.
Seven.
Which is somewhere quite phenomenal, really. It says a lot about the organisation of the union. It could actually last. I mean, the last 2 weeks must have been in total defiance of the union, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. Absolutely. Last 3 weeks, actually, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
We were defying them from about fucking 5 days after the start, I tell you.
Well, that's quite interesting, you know. Obviously, I've picked up quite a bit on this strike, but this, you know, this whole issue of on the role of the leadership. Well, I think Danny more or less said that the union leadership lacked the strike as well. And it was quite so emphatic about it, because
I am emphatic because I was there.
Yeah. I think he recognised that, but obviously. He also thought they were. I can't remember his. I must listen to that tape and take some notes, because he did mention some other things he thought were wrong. I think obviously part of it was the fact that he didn't take all of Liverpool, though he thought most of Liverpool joined it.
Did.
Yeah. See, this is the thing. If you try to do history by just press reports, you're knackered, because the maximum they said was 12,000. They quoted, there must have been more than that.
But there was. After the first week, it got down to it's about 12,000, and then it began to steadily decline.
Yeah. With Hull, and then the decision to actually go for the Blue.
Yeah.
Now, there was that sort of period between October, November, 45. 54, mm-hmm. and when the strike started. What actually happened in that in-between period?
Oh, yeah, this is very important. The Blue Union really got off the ground because the leadership in Hull had said, we want to lead the TNG and we're going for it. As I explained before, it was a very immature, extremely inexperienced leadership. But it was the only one that really existed. The TNG had been so discredited that they could not mount any resistance to that leadership. In Birkenhead, there was probably the strongest, most homogeneous leadership in any port. Namely, people who were very influenced by the Trotskyist organisation, the SLL, and who were members, or those who weren't, were influenced by the ones who were members of the SLL. And the workers were very pissed off with the TNG led by this full-time bureaucrat O'Hare. Now, in Liverpool, the situation was a bit different. There was a general discontent with the TNG. It's quite widespread. But the Port Works Committee had always been rather more conservative than the Birkenhead Port Works Committee. The Trotskyists didn't have any individual members in Liverpool at all.
None at all?
None at all in the docks. None whatsoever. They had people like Jimmy Bembo who were friendly to the Birkenhead leaders. But to be honest, they were more friendly to the Birkenhead leaders than they were friendly to Trotskyism. Mm. The fact that Birkenhead leaders happened to be Trotskyists was a bit accidental. And then the only organised political leadership in Liverpool was in number 3 dock, known affectionately as the Kremlin, which was led by a former full-time boxer called Johnny Lydon.
Yeah.
So, when the Blue Union sent its forces up to Liverpool. They sent forces up in the very late autumn of 1954. You'll have to check on the exact dates for yourself. And they sent a group of people up who were mainly stevedores. And they opened recruiting offices at every dock in Liverpool. And they'd ridden this very successful wave in Birkenhead. They'd ridden this really ultra-successful wave They'd ridden this very successful wave in Hull. This ultra-successful wave in Birkenhead. And naively, they expected the same things would happen in Liverpool. And it didn't. It's quite different. In Liverpool, there was the best militants wanted to go in. People who had got sort of strong attachments to the TNG for all sort of historical or careerist reasons didn't. Then in the middle is this great undecided layer who really would like to go in but were unsure whether they're going to be successful. And as you know, that in politics, leadership is always very decisive. Coming back to Birkenhead, they had a leadership, it was established, it had a tradition, the workers look towards it, and therefore it could take them. In Liverpool, the leadership hadn't quite got that. Also, the Blue Union people who came up were, in general, people who had no idea about how to organise that kind of struggle. They thought all they had to do was sit in a bleeding office and people come along and join.
Would this be Newman?
Yeah.
And well, who else came up?
Stebbing. And I'm trying to think of the brothers. At that time, I was a full-time worker for the what is now the WRP, which eventually became the SLL, but was called the group. It was the Healyite organisation. But because of my connections with all the Birkenhead Dockers, I was very much linked into all this. And then, when they realised that the recruitment was not going as smoothly as they'd hoped, and they got thrown into a crisis, they began to look around for ideas. And I attended some discussions with them. And they asked me, would I be prepared to go and work full-time for the union as a recruiting officer in number 5, the Canada Dock, where Peter Kerrigan was the leading light in the union. And, of course, I said I was only prepared to oblige. Then I pointed out something else to them, that if you were going to recruit these workers, that you had to waste propaganda. That whilst they all wanted to join, they wanted to be sure that what they were joining was viable, had a chance of success. And therefore it was necessary to have a newspaper. And again, they thought, at first this was a bit silly, and what do you want these newspapers for? Because you had the Daily Herald every day, or some other bloody paper. Yeah. And I pointed out how if the workers had their own newspaper, it could transmit to them the truth, counter the arguments of TNG, and explain to them all the sort of doubts that they had about transferring union membership. Now, I didn't win on the eloquence of my argument. I won on the fact that they got themselves into a situation where they saw that success was not as easy as they'd imagined. And they were beginning to panic.
I mean, they'd expected the men just to
That's walk right, into the walk in.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trotsky makes this point in when he's discussing history. He says that the party is the midwife of the revolution who has to perform the caesarean operation. And in Liverpool, the child just slid out of the womb, so in Birkenhead, sorry, slid out of the womb so easily. In fucking Liverpool, it didn't slide out of the womb like that. Its inclination was to get out of the womb. It wanted to go out of the womb, but it wasn't sure. And they panicked, and they had a choice. They either had to pack the bags and leave Liverpool. Because Liverpool City was a real hard slog. Mm. Or they had to say, we've put everything on the line, we've staked our all on this, and we have to get these bloody people to come and join our union now. Mm. And that we can't settle for 1,000 members here, because Liverpool at that time had a dot labour force, very close to 18,000 probably. Mm. And we have to get a minimum of 12,000 to 14,000. Because recognition and all these issues is going to be decided by a thing called the relationship of forces.
Yeah.
Not by the eloquence of arguments. So therefore I found myself promoted, not only to become an official and on the payroll of the union, but actually as editor of a paper called News of the Blues.
Yeah.
Which they agreed we should have a weekly paper which would agitate and
argue. Actually weekly, was it?
Yeah, it came out weekly.
It
did have periodic spells and it didn't quite appear weekly, but the general aim was for a weekly paper.
You wouldn't believe it from the amount that survived, actually.
Now, I mean, I suppose that was our objective, a weekly paper. A lot of weeks it didn't appear.
Yeah.
But that, we did have a, it came out fairly regularly. I think we sold it for a penny at each control, and its sale was in the thousands. Because lots of workers who weren't sure about whether they could get away with joining the Blue, but wanted to join the Blue, would read the paper, because this is what gave them reports, information and news.
Well, what sort of pressures were on them in Liverpool to stop them joining the Blue that weren't on in Birkenhead, for instance?
Oh, the same pressures were on in both places. But in Birkenhead, they'd already accepted that their leaders were not the TNG. Their leaders were the unofficial committee. In Liverpool, the unofficial committee had never been able to completely win permanent, regular support from the men. They could lead a particular strike, but they had not established an authority that went beyond the strike and particular battles on the job. Yeah. To something that carried through in the everyday life of the workers. Do you want to make myself clear on that?
Yeah.
If I'm not yourself.
No, well, the thing I was thinking of was that one of the impressions I got off Danny, for instance, was that all the initiatives for strikes and actions before 54 came from the Birkenhead men anyway.
In general, it did.
And they actually sort of got onto the Liverpool men to support them rather than the Liverpool men taking their initiatives.
That's true. In many ways, the Liverpool Port Workers Committee was built up a bit in the shadow of the Birkenhead Port Workers Committee. And just repeat what I said a minute ago, but it is worth stressing this point, that the Liverpool Port Workers Committee therefore did not have the hegemony, to use this dreadful bloody word that sociologists are so fond of, that the Birkenhead Port Workers Committee enjoyed.
Yeah.
Now, it therefore had to fight for that, had to struggle for that. The pressure that existed on all these workers was, would you get your book? And what I mean by this, would you get your book or not, was that to become a dock worker required registration. And every 6 months, you went to the dock bearer board, you issued a book on the production of your union card. And without the production of a union card, you would not get this book. And the TNG openly bragged that there is no way these blue union people will be given a book because they don't have trade union cards. And therefore, this was always going to be decisive quick. Now, that's the press that beat down on Liverpool. In Birkenhead, they were pretty confident that they would because they knew they'd all joined. And they'd all joined because they had a leadership that they all in general gave their confidence to. Doesn't mean they wouldn't have criticisms of it, but that was the only leadership that they recognised. That didn't exist in Liverpool if they all didn't join.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a catch 22 situation.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is that the people that the Blue Union had sent up to Liverpool could not have organised a piss up in a brewery. They were sent extremely conservative stevedores, timid people, who at the level of the job would fight us for wages and conditions, but had no vision. And were quite put out when they found that all these workers didn't come and love them. And one of the first things we did was to wage a campaign to bring to Liverpool the accredited leaders of the old unofficial movement on a national scale. And what we were able to do is to put pressure on Barrett. I'm just going to check the proof. Let me go and see how. Barrett had understood that it was all or nothing. And in these situations, people turn towards other people who they think have got ideas, vision, senses of organisation. And what Barrett found himself confronted with, he had to fight, on one hand, the Dock Labour Board. He had to fight a Tory government that was certainly not very keen at all on having the Blue Union in control of the docks, because they saw the Blue Union as uncontrollable. Because the Blue Union had this nasty clause in which it called strikes via mass meetings.
That's right.
Where the TNG was a union that was completely dominated by full-time officials whose jobs depended on meeting the needs of its union leadership that were that time extremely extremely conservative, very bureaucratic, and were to the right even of the Labour leadership. So the Tories felt much more happy, much more assured with the TNG leadership. It's not that they saw in Barrett some enraging revolutionary. They saw in Barrett some person who was incapable of controlling his own rank and file. So Barrett sees all these forces around him, and the only people who were prepared to give conscious aid and assistance, not in the terms very much materially, they had no money, they couldn't fucking finance it, the terms of ideas, was the Peelite group.
So Barrett was actually conscious, he knew what was going on in Birkenhead, he knew who these
people were. Oh yes. Barrett used to have regular discussions with Gerry Healy.
Oh, that's incredible, isn't
it? Yes.
And you wouldn't actually, well, that's something that doesn't come across actually.
Oh yes, he did have regular discussions with Gerry Healy.
Yeah.
And his supporters, there were two brothers called Hurley, H-G-R.
Yes, I've come across the names here. Yeah.
I think H-G-R-L-E-Y.
It's usually spelled H-U-R-L-E-Y, isn't it?
It's wrong, that's the wrong spelling.
Is it the wrong spelling? Yeah. That's in the press, that is. I've come across those names.
It's the wrong spelling. Anyhow, they were very anxious that I should go and work for the union. Mm. How the fucking hell could he? He's this professional revolutionary. Mm. He's never been a docker. This union had a constitution. You could only be a full-timer if you'd been a docker.
Yeah.
Yet they took me on. Yeah. Broke all their constitution. Because they said, look, these people can do these things. We can't. They can produce this newspaper. Yeah. And in other words, they leaned on the only possible source of support that they had. Mm. And
well, that's interesting, actually. I mean, they actually didn't have the confidence to actually organise themselves. Oh. I mean, after all these years of being in the blue union.
But look, you see, for years they had led a union of about 9,000 people.
7,000 is easy.
7,000, 5,000 stevedores, 2,000 doctors, yeah. Correct that, yes, yeah. Sorry. They had never been confronted with a struggle against the forces of the bourgeois state, forces of the official Labour Party, the forces of the fucking Labour Board, the forces of the Communist Party. Every other factor in society was against them.
Yeah.
And therefore they had to turn to somebody they thought had got some ideas in their head. Now, what made the Trotskyists attractive was that firstly, they had an explanation of what had led to this dispute. Secondly, they had an explanation of what you should do, about who you should recruit and organise. Thirdly, they could prove that. Hadn't they gone along to Hull, made an intervention in the Hull strike where they hadn't got any forces, and actually helped to swing Hull over to the Blue Union? In Birkenhead, they demonstrated most conclusively could tie a bloody port up. And if you wanted to get into Liverpool and Manchester, they were the forces that could do it. And therefore that led to this absolutely exceptional and unforeseeable situation where Barrett's just rested for support on people like Healy, and where in the port of Liverpool, all these quite conservative, unsure stevedores turned to me and fucking made me a meeting. I can't remember the name of the hotel that they were staying at, but I attended a meeting there where Newman moved me as editor of the News of the Blues.
Yeah.
The same man a few months later had gone over to the employing class and wrote an article for the Sunday paper, the Empire News, of dreadful Trotskyist infiltration into the Blue Union.
Oh, incredible. Was that in the Empire News, was it?
Yeah.
I must check that out, actually. Yeah. That would be really interesting.
So,
was that would be about May 55, would it, or June 55?
Made you.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the next thing is that there was lurking in London these people like Constable and Aylward, the mass leaders.
This is, yeah. What sort of role was Harry playing in Liverpool at the time then? Was he actually down there regularly?
At that time, no. Mm. But he had then joined the Blue Union. And I better explain something about Constable. I don't know if the dot commas in Broken Head explain this. Constable had been expelled from the TNG after leading the 1951 wages dispute. He didn't rejoin, he didn't join the Blue Union. He waged the fight to be readmitted back into the TNG. And when he went for his book, he went for his book with no union card in his hand. And the employers in the docks of London said, you can't have a job. Whereupon the entire port of London stops in solidarity. Here is a port that's completely dedicated. Nobody shall work without a union card. They struck to demand that Constable be allowed to work. Even the end of fucking union card. Which, you know, is a sort of bit of the dialectic of the stuff. They were quite correct to do
absolutely,
so.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because he was insisting on his right to go back in the TNG.
Yeah.
Constable then joined the Blue Union.
Yeah.
At the peak of this struggle.
So he didn't actually join until 54?
No. He didn't.
That's interesting, because Dickens and Saunders.
The others, Dickens and Saunders had joined earlier.
Yeah.
And therefore there was a demand that we said we bring Constable. We said if you're going to win, you have to bring your leaders up. Mm. The leaders who have credibility, because these people that sent up from London, not, as I said earlier to you, had no credibility, no vision, no sense of organisation. And so, eventually, Constable and Aylward were sent up. Aylward was sent up in charge. Now, he'd been in the Blue Union since the 20s. He was part of the original breakaway from the TNG.
So he was a docker rather than Steve Dole?
Yeah, he was a docker, yes.
And
he eventually, after the strike, became elected as National Dock Secretary. And Constable came up. Now, that had the effect of producing a team in combination with Birkenhead and Liverpool of people with authority, credibility, and also, as I said, people of imagination who could actually organise a struggle.
So when would Harry Constable come up to Liverpool?
I can't remember the date.
Well, around the, what, 55 or early 55 or late 54?
It was probably early 55, but I mean, I think you should try and check on that.
It's difficult because there's no mention of him coming up, other than, actually there is occasionally, but there's no mention of him being there for, you know, organising. But I mean, it would be silly to imagine that someone like Harry Constable wouldn't be there. Because, I mean, obviously, actually, no, I tell a lie. There was one report somewhere in the paper which actually said Harry Constable was brought up full-time into Liverpool.
You'd find the reference sources, if you can get them, in the court action that took place.
What, the spring one?
Yeah.
The 56
right,
one,
yes, yeah.
Yeah.
You would.
I could go through the law reports are very boring, actually, but you can go through them. Yeah.
There's a lovely scene in that, I'm interspersing it here,
yeah.
Where someone said, was Mr. Constable well known? And this docker at the back of the court said, yeah, and what a gooser. And the big said, what is meant by that? He was a good gooser, yes. And I'm pretty sure that you get that.
Yeah.
In those bloody awful, boring law.
Yeah.
When I sat in that court for days, it was dreadful. Absolutely dreadful.
There were a few funny exchanges between the judge and the defendants.
That's right, they were.
The one where the union official is being examined by the judge, and the union official says, he says to him, someone says, well, you know, he was actually the union official, but he was also on the dock labour board. And so the judge says, so in fact, whatever this bloke's name, he was actually both an employer and an employee at the same time.
Right.
And the bloke says, yeah, yes, my lord, you know, also, you know, very earnest. He says, and the judge says, I find this very strange. Because the judge couldn't realise why someone could be an employer and an employee at the same time. So. It's a lovely little exchange, actually.
Anyhow, Constable probably went up in the early part of 55.
Yeah.
The first crunch for the Blue Union was going to come on the issue of the books.
Yeah.
And the Blue Union had a massive victory here. Massive victory.
Yes, Danny talked about this, yeah.
we organised it extremely well. We made sure that we got speakers at every dock gate that morning. We sent in a trial case. The idea was if the guy, I can't remember his name, if he got refused his book, pout! And it was everywhere. Mm. We were dying for them to refuse his book. Mm. We set up a telephone command system between Hull, Manchester and so on. This guy did get... He was refused. Mm. By lunchtime, the dock level would have utterly capitulated. Afternoon completely capitulated.
As quick as that?
Yeah. It was over within a matter of a few hours. Mm. Now, it was over because what was involved for most dockers, irrespective of their feelings on the Blue and the TNG, is that their workmates were not going to be allowed to work. But of course, once it had been shown that you could actually get your book to work and be a member of a different trade union, the recruitment to the Blue Union took an enormous impulse forward. Yeah. And we were down there with fucking union cars and recruiting as fast as hell.
How many do you reckon you recruited then?
I reckon that put the union membership up 2,000 or 3,000 within a matter of a few weeks.
So what do you reckon the maximum the Blue made? The maximum numbers?
Now here we come. In Liverpool, we come to the trickiest part of all.
The main reason I ask this is because the Blue consistently refused to give membership figures for Liverpool.
I did an estimate once in where I worked out on paying members that the Blue Union had close on 12,000 members in Liverpool. However, what I could never be sure of, and have no way of ever checking, and nobody ever will have, is how many of those 12,000 held your membership?
This is somewhere I've been told a lot of members.
This is an insoluble problem. What I would stress, and I would defend this argument against anybody else, and that's why I want to be very honest about not should only do your membership. If the Blue Union had gained recognition, it would have mopped up almost the entire port of Liverpool.
Yeah.
The treacherous role of the Transport and General Workers Union leadership, its determination to exclude its membership from any say in the controlling room of the union, had created a real mass opposition on a scale that's not existed anywhere else. I mean, the Pilkington's thing was fiddling compared to this. Mm. And also the difference was that at Pilkington's, when the workers tried to make a breakaway, that there was no alternative. On the docks, a genuine alternative existed. Another union, which in actual fact had a history longer even than the TNG.
Yeah, much longer, really.
Yeah.
1870.
Yeah. Now, I think there's a big difference between saying we should form a union of our own, brothers and sisters, to saying, no, we should move into that union.
Yeah, that's interesting because Danny Brandon was saying, especially in I took his word, you know, the way Danny thinks about it, he said that actually the Birkenhead men had considered splitting off and trying to form their own union on a number of occasions, but always at the last minute, never, you know, actually gone forward. They actually obviously had fears about themselves, they never actually pushed themselves forward. But they had talked about it on a number of occasions.
I mean, in general, history has demonstrated time after time this is...
Yeah.
I mean, as I explained to you, that the Trotskyists were sceptical even moving into the Blue Union.
Yeah.
And it was only after very long discussions and time after time reviewing it that it was agreed.
Yeah.
And only when Hull sparked it off that they said, well, this is it, we've got to take a side, take a decision.
Yeah.
And as I say, I believe that you'll never ever get to, in April, May 55, what the real membership was in Liverpool. In Manchester, they had a majority. In Hull, they certainly had a hefty majority. And in Birkenhead, they had, and I've used this dreadful word before, hegemony.
Yeah.
In Liverpool, they had roughly two-thirds of the dock labour force that held cards. Now, how many of that two-thirds, as I say, held your membership?
Mm.
What I think it indicates is that that's where people did want to go and were prepared to go. I'll get our food, shall I?
Before we actually go on to the recognition dispute, just a few words about the different groups which were supporting the Blues. Obviously, I'm interested in the role the Tribune group plays in, and the sort of relationships between Healy group and Tribune. But also, in passing, I might remember the supporter groups like the ILP as well, who threw the weight behind the Blue. I don't know if you know.
Well, we'll deal with the ILP very quickly.
Yeah.
Their support for the Blue Union was purely propagandist.
Yeah.
They had no base in industry.
Yeah.
They had certainly no base on the docks. And no forces in the towns except London where there was any ports. Mm. So whilst they wrote and argued that the Blue Union should be given recognition, to be fair to them, it didn't matter. It didn't contribute anything at all practical.
So they didn't do anything on the docks, they didn't go down and sell or anything like that?
I never saw them selling the paper. I think they did sell it in London. But I mean, that's hardly constituting support.
Yeah, yeah.
And their ability to influence, let's put it more precisely, they had no ability to influence any events.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have either the size of a national organisation. Although that didn't always determine, because you can be very small, but you can have people in key strategic places. They had neither.
So they were the factor.
Yeah, they weren't the factor, no.
Yeah. Tribune was a different
kettle of fish. Firstly, that Tribune was then associated in everybody's minds as being the sort of left opposition to the right-wing Labour leadership. And another very, very, very important thing is that Deacon was a rabid anti-Bevanite. And the way that the Bevanite wing had been kept down in the Labour Party, at least in the organisational sense, was the use of the block vote by the TNG, the Municipal and General Workers Union, and the NUM, which had consistently smashed the left of the Labour Party conference. Now, there's another thing that mattered too, and this is worth you taking into account, that the left trade unions then were very different than the left trade unions today. Because what do we mean by the left trade unions in that period? We're speaking of the electrical trade union, it wasn't the EPTU then. We're speaking of the fire brigade union, we're speaking of unions like the sheet metal workers, etc. And the left of the trade unions was led by the Stalinists, which, or more precisely, whose attitude to Bevanism was much more ambivalent. On one hand, they were hostile to the right wing. On the other hand, they were very chary about Bevanism, because Bevanism threatened to reach out to leftward moving workers. It was where the CP saw its hopes. And therefore, they had quite a sectarian attitude to the Bevanites. And the other point is that the CND, CP supported multilateralism and were against unilateralism right until 1961, where the Bevanite movement then was a unilateralist movement. So how does this therefore affect the Bevanites' attitudes to the dock strike? Well, a number of strands. Here you are, you're a group of Labour left MPs, and a small minority of leading trade unionists. On one hand, you've got the right wing headed by Deacon and company wanting to tear your bloody balls off. And on the other hand, you've got the CP keeping their membership and their base a bit at arm's length from you.
Mm-hmm.
So you're naturally going to be a little bit interested in wherever you can get support. And the Blue Union looked a possible source. Now, what are the subjective factors? that the SLL was at that time the biggest organised left, far left force inside the Labour Party.
Mm.
And when I use the term far left, I'm using it in the sense that it was against classical reformers and of people who consider themselves Trotskyists. Mm. I mean, you can always have a big argument about which group is Trotskyist and which is not, but so we'll therefore use this term far left, it's probably easier. And therefore its orientation lay towards a tribute, because the SLL had this sort of scenario that they would develop inside the Labour Party in opposition to the right wing. And that opposition would essentially be led by left reformers. Mm. And these left reformers in the struggle against the right wing will be forced to seek solutions beyond classical left reformism. And this would therefore tend to project them in the direction of centrism. And it was very much on the cards, there was some possibility that there would be splits inside the Labour Party, which would result in the formation of a centrist party headed by the Tribunite wing, which would then open up a new field for...
Yeah.
So therefore, the SLL had a very strong orientation to Tribune. Yeah. And if they were able to win and influence the leadership of the NASD, i.e. the Blue Union, that would have given them an industrial base to intervene